Good morning, Africa. Today is Thursday, April 29th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, India's COVID-19 death toll keeps rising.
Shortages of oxygen, medical supplies, and hospital staff have compounded a record number of new infections.
Also ahead, the latest in Somalia's election dispute.
The opposition welcomed Farmajo's announcement Tuesday, but remain skeptical about the next moves.
Plus, U.S. President Joe Biden addresses Congress. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in India, where the country's COVID-19 death toll surpassed 200,000 Wednesday. The country also passed a daily death toll record with 3,300 killed from the disease. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has the story.
Struggling to breathe, coronavirus sufferers flock to a Sikh temple on New Delhi's outskirts, hoping to get some of the limited supplies of oxygen it's been handing out, as India's death toll surged past 200,000 on Wednesday. Shortages of oxygen, medical supplies, and hospital staff have compounded a record number of new infections, at least 300,000 people a day over the past week. Wednesday also set another new record for those killed in a single day, almost 3,300 people. Healthcare facilities are overwhelmed, as are crematoriums. A grim scene captures the sheer number of dead. Row upon row of bodies burning on makeshift platforms as cremation grounds have become overrun. Across New Delhi, people are turning to temporary facilities, undertaking mass burials and cremations. Mourners have turned to parking lots and parks as families grow desperate to bury their loved ones. Ambulances carrying bodies of victims are waiting in line for hours. International help is starting to get through, though. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday he intends to share vaccines with India and other countries. Supplies arriving in New Delhi included ventilators and oxygen concentrators from Britain, with more sent from Australia, Germany and Ireland, while Singapore and Russia pledged oxygen cylinders and medical supplies.
That was Lucy Fielder of Reuters. As the death toll in India rises, Indians have struggled to register online for a mass vaccination drive that is set to begin at the weekend. But India is far from the only part of the world in need of vaccines. On Wednesday, European Union lawyers demanded that AstraZeneca immediately deliver COVID-19 vaccines from its factories in Britain. The EU is averaging over 135,000 new cases and over 2,300 new deaths each day over the past week. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
The call came in the opening hearing of the European Commission's legal case in Brussels against the drug maker over supply delays. AstraZeneca has missed delivery targets to both Britain and the EU, delaying the bloc's immunisation campaign and further stoking tensions between London and Brussels. The bloc accuses the company of failing to meet its contractual obligations, but AstraZeneca says it is complying with the agreement, which it considers not fully binding. The contract lists four vaccine-making plants, two of which are in Britain. AstraZeneca has delivered doses to the EU from sites in Belgium and the Netherlands, but it has not shipped any dose produced in UK plants to the EU. The UK government has denied imposing export curbs and is seeking extra doses from a factory in the Netherlands run by an AstraZeneca subcontractor. The EU is now blocking exports from that plant. With the pandemic still raging across the continent, the AstraZeneca vaccine was seen as a central part of Europe's inoculation effort. But cuts and delays in deliveries have disrupted the campaign in the EU, which trails behind Britain on vaccinations. By the end of March, AstraZeneca had delivered only a quarter of what it had committed to the EU. It blamed production problems for the delays. The EU lawyers asked for a decision before the end of June to make sure missing doses could be delivered in a timely fashion.
That was Emma McCarthy of Reuters. Meanwhile, there is some good news on the vaccine front in terms of efficacy. Data released Wednesday from Public Health England showed that COVID-19 vaccines deployed in England can cut transmission of the coronavirus in households by up to half. That's in addition to the protection the shots offer against symptomatic infection. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
A study in England is reporting that the coronavirus vaccines in use there can cut transmission of the disease by up to half. The research from Public Health England focused on households and offers insight into one of the big unknowns of COVID-19 vaccinations, the extent to which they can keep you from passing it on to other people. The study says people who became infected with the coronavirus 3 weeks after receiving one dose of Pfizer or AstraZeneca vaccine were between 38% to 49% less likely to pass it on to people in their home compared to those who were unvaccinated. Mary Ramsey, head of immunization at PHE, said that while these findings are very encouraging, even if you have been vaccinated, it's really important that you continue to act like you have the virus. The study included over 57,000 contacts from 24,000 households in which there was a confirmed case that had received a vaccination, compared with nearly 1 million contacts of unvaccinated cases.
That was Soraya Ali of Reuters. In the U.S., President Joe Biden delivered his first speech to a joint session of Congress late Wednesday. Biden touted his administration's rollout of over 200 million COVID-19 vaccine doses in his first 100 days in office.
Everyone over the age of 16, everyone is now eligible to get vaccinated. Right now, right away. Go get vaccinated, America. Go and get the vaccination. They're available.
Biden delivered the address in front of about 200 socially distanced mask-wearing lawmakers and key U.S. officials. Before the coronavirus, about 1,600 people would have attended. Biden highlighted his economic rescue package, known as the American Rescue Plan.
Thanks to the American Rescue Plan, we're on track to cut child poverty in America in half this year. And in the process, while this is all going on, the economy created more than 1,300,000 new jobs in 100 days.
The U.S. president also called for stricter gun control, stressed the need for global engagement and cooperation on everything from the COVID-19 pandemic to climate change, and he called for reforms to U.S. policing. For more in-depth coverage of Biden's speech and the Republican response, please visit voanews.com or tune in to this evening's International Edition with Chinedu Ofor. The U.S. has the largest COVID-19 outbreak on Earth, but infection and death rates have not been shared equally among racial groups. Black Americans in particular have been far more likely to become ill and die from the disease. To find out what's behind this trend, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Monica Webb Hooper, who is the deputy director of the National Institute on Health and Health Disparities at the National Institutes of Health here in Washington, D.C. Here's a clip of their conversation.
The populations that we focus on are racial and ethnic minoritized populations, populations with less socioeconomic privilege or less money, less education, and those who are often discriminated against or excluded. And we are focused on improving minority health and reducing these disparities in population subgroups.
And how do you do that?
One way we do that is first understanding what disparities exist. So we have to collect data for helping us track and monitor disparities over time. That's the only way we would know if disparities are closing, if the gaps are widening, and those are points of intervention. Once we identify specific health disparities, we focus on how do we reduce those so that everyone has the optimal chance to have good health.
The current pandemic must have given you lots of material to work with.
Yes. And the data tell us that individuals who are considered racial and ethnic minorities have higher rates of cases of COVID-19, more likely to be in the hospital, and more likely to die compared to the majority population, white individuals who are not Hispanic or Latino.
What are the common features of the disparities you've identified?
they really come down to a few buckets. They are related to health and healthcare differences, those with less money, less health insurance, and who are largely racial ethnic minority. And then also socioeconomics are a big part of that, which includes, you know, having access to employment that would provide you, for instance, with the opportunity to work from home and to have a computer at home and internet access. So the things that provide you with the ability to avoid being exposed to COVID-19.
What's one typical example of that?
Let's take a warehouse, for instance, where there are low-wage workers who are exposed, who don't have proper hand-washing stations and sanitizing materials, and they don't have masks. And so they're in this environment working with lots of other people and lots of opportunity to be exposed to COVID-19, and the organization doesn't prioritize that. And by getting that data in hand, you have an opportunity to develop strategies to change these systems and move us toward everyone having good health.
You said there are deeper, more fundamental factors at work here.
We can't ignore the kind of backdrop of just structural inequities.
Meaning?
Injustices, things that are not fair.
Do you think that maybe people in the mainstream, including policymakers, simply may not care if minorities sometimes get left out of the health equation?
You know, I'd like to believe, and I do believe, that most people are good and that most people believe in fairness and injustice and access to high quality healthcare for everyone. I do, however, think that these unfair aspects are just baked into the system. So they almost become invisible unless you're really looking for them or unless you're directly affected by them. That's why it's really important for us to talk about these issues, because that's our only opportunity for these systems to change.
Of course, equity sounds like a great idea, but what practical difference does the idea make?
It's more than an idea. COVID-19 has opened up conversations about this topic in a way that I've never observed. And while we have the world's attention on health disparities and the poor health received by certain groups, we have to capitalize on this moment. If we don't, we risk it only remaining an aspiration. And I think that from the NIH perspective, as we work with scientists, we generate the science, the data needed to help make those changes possible. Putting the science behind these concepts, because believe it or not, there are many people who never thought about this and who don't believe it's real. And even to begin to convince them, we need hardcore, indisputable data. So we've got work to do.
That was Monica Webb Hooper of the National Institutes of Health speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. This is VOA. A study published Wednesday shows nearly all the world's glaciers have been melting at an accelerated pace in recent years, accounting for rises in sea level over the last two decades. The study was published in the science journal Nature and says that glaciers lost an average of 267 billion tons of ice per year. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate on Wednesday approved a measure to restore regulation of emissions of the potent greenhouse gas methane. The regulations had been withdrawn under former President Donald Trump. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters that passing the bill could help the Biden administration carry out its plan to slash U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by half over the next decade. Also in the U.S., Wednesday saw developments in numerous cases of killings of black and brown people. The Justice Department brought federal hate crimes charges against three men accused of chasing and fatally shooting 25-year-old black man Ahmaud Arbery in 2020. Meanwhile, in Delaware, the sister of 30-year-old black man Lyman Moses sued three police officers Wednesday who had shot and killed Moses in his car in January of this year. In Chicago, a newly released video shows that a 22-year-old Latino man was fleeing police, had his back turned, and appeared to have a gun when an officer fatally shot him. And in North Carolina, protests broke out in Elizabeth City after a judge denied requests to release body camera video showing the police killing of black man Andrew Brown Jr. last week.
This is Science in a Minute. The north and south geographic poles that cap Earth's rotational axis are not in fixed positions, but slowly drift over time. A new Chinese-led study published in the geophysical journal Letters suggests melting glacial ice due to human-caused climate change may now be a factor in what is affecting the axis shift. Study authors say Earth's polar axis drift was heading south until the mid-1990s, when scientists noticed it had made an abrupt change to an eastern direction. They also noted that between 1995 and 2020, the speed of the axis drift increased by about 17 times from the average recorded between 1981 to 1995. While it may sound ominous, researchers say these changes in the Earth's axis should not impact our daily lives. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Somalia's opposition politicians have cautiously welcomed the president's move to drop a controversial 2-year extension of his term in office. Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
There was a sigh of relief in Somalia's capital after President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, better known as Farmajo, said he will drop the 2-year extension the lower house of parliament gave him earlier this month. Forces loyal to opposition leaders and government security agencies had clashed in Mogadishu on Sunday, injuring several people. Residents who fled their neighborhoods are going home now that President Farmajo and Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble are calling for calm and a return to a complicated 15-point agreement on election process signed September 17 of last year. The opposition welcomed Farmajo's announcement Tuesday, but remained skeptical about the next moves by the president, whose term in office expired in February. Abdulrahman Abshakur is a presidential candidate and the leader of Wadajir political party. He says Farmajo is still not clear on the way forward.
Our position is, in order to reach inclusive agreement, the talks must be inclusive by including all stakeholders to resolve all outstanding issues once for all. I don't see Farmajo has backed down. His agenda of for 2 years extension still is looking excuse, and he is plotting with the former speaker of the lower house to reject and to fail the 17th September agreement.
President Farmajo bowed to pressure on Tuesday after the leaders of Hirshabelle and Galmudug states, who initially supported his bid for term extension, reversed their decision. The Speaker of the Lower House of Parliament has confirmed an extraordinary session on Saturday to formally nullify the extension. The federal government, the opposition and state governments still have to reach agreement on the process for presidential and parliamentary elections. Abdimalik Abdullahi is a Somali analyst affairs. He says all parties should negotiate in good faith with the help of an envoy appointed by the African Union.
The incoming AU envoy would be better suited to mediate, oversee the negotiations, build bridges, and act as a guarantor as well. The September 17 agreement and the BW recommendations should form the basis of the forthcoming talks. If any of the BATs brings to the fourth any other valid issues and genuine concerns that have appeared with the electoral process, it should be accommodated as well.
The United States has urged federal government leaders to resume dialogue immediately, saying political conflict will only destroy Somalia's hopes for peace and stability. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Leading media organizations and watchdogs have issued a new report concerning threats to press freedom across Europe. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Leading media organizations and watchdog groups have issued a new report concerning threats to press freedom across Europe. It documents a record number of reported violations, including physical attacks, harassment, intimidation, and online violence against journalists in 2020, in some cases intensified by COVID-19 pandemic measures. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has a story from Paris. Text. This is the third annual report authored by media groups partnering with the 47-member Council of Europe to promote press protection and safety in a region stretching from Portugal to Russia. Among its key findings, eroding legal protections for journalists and government interference are threatening free expression and the media's role as watchdog against abuse. William Horsley, media freedom representative with the Association of European Journalists, said 2020 saw a record 201 reported press freedom violations, up 40% from the previous year.
There's also a record number of 52 alerts for violent assaults and acts, including two deaths, one in Albania, one in Russia, and a record number 70 related to acts of intimidation, harassment of journalists in person or online, many of them in the street at protests. Other alert categories are imprisonment, impunity, and other acts having a chilling effect on media freedom.
Horsley said about half the reported violations were committed by politicians and public officials. In countries like Poland and Hungary, the report said, authorities essentially blacklisted media critical of them in favor of government-friendly ones. In other cases like Turkey and Russia, it found a monopolization of media outlets curbed diversity of expression. The report found COVID-19 health restrictions further curbed media freedoms in many countries, sometimes increasing surveillance and restricting journalists' ability to cover the pandemic, including at the risk of criminal penalties. It also described expensive bogus lawsuits and other measures by powerful entities aimed at silencing critical media coverage. Those measures are known as strategic lawsuits against public participation or SLAPs. The report also highlighted growing online harassment, especially against female journalists.
They are increasingly victims of sexist insults and threats. There have been cases in Serbia, Spain, in a context of total impunity.
Ricardo Gutierrez is General Secretary for the European Federation of Journalists.
Our report denounces the passivity of online platforms and public authorities in the face of these threats.
The report outlines measures to protect press freedoms and echoes some of the findings on COVID-19-related restrictions in Reporters Without Borders' latest global report. Here in Europe, it said, the policies went against the Council of Europe's warnings against restricting public access to information. Overall, it found little progress since 2016, when member states themselves agreed that attacks on journalism and media freedom had become alarming and unacceptable. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The International Council of Nurses warns that the world is facing a nursing crisis and can expect a significant shortage in the global nursing workforce in the next few years. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The global nursing workforce of 27 million is likely to be cut in half in the next few years. The International Council of Nurses says its latest survey of 64 national nursing associations finds disputes over pay, working conditions, violence, and intimidation are causing nurses to leave their profession. Then there's the so-called COVID-19 effect. The report finds lack of protection and long and stressful shifts are having a profound impact on the mental health of nurses across the globe. ICN Chief Executive Officer Howard Catton says politicians and leaders have recognized the value of nurses in terms of their care and compassion. However, he says they have not recognized their value to society and compensated them accordingly.
That, I think, is very much also at the heart of the discontent, the unhappiness, some of the actions that we are seeing from nurses around the world, this chasm between the rhetoric, the positive rhetoric for nurses, but the paucity of practical action and practical responses to support nurses.
Strikes over nurses' pay and working conditions have broken out in Zimbabwe, in Lebanon, in Northern Ireland, in the United States, and elsewhere. The report says disputes, growing discontent, and concerns such as protection at work are undermining people's interest in pursuing a career in nursing. Another problem confronting the profession, says Catton, is the disruption of nurses' education by the pandemic. He says that is resulting in a 6 to 12 month delay in new nurses.
So those delays in the pipeline coming through, the rise in discontent, unhappiness, both we think again have the potential to impact negatively on both recruitment to and retention, recruitment to the nursing profession and the retention of those nurses that we already have.
These issues and concerns exist throughout the world, but are more pronounced in low and middle income countries. That is leading to a growing brain drain. The report notes a significant exodus of nurses in developing countries going to richer countries where pay and conditions are better. At the same time, the ICN report says some of the richer countries are actively seeking to recruit nurses in the poorer countries to reduce the shortages they are experiencing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Since the coronavirus pandemic made travel unsafe, world's leaders have taken their diplomacy digital, opening up new possibilities for engagements, but also new concerns about fairness and transparency, and the occasional awkward moment. VOA's Anita Powell has been following this story virtually, of course. She reports from Johannesburg.
Diplomacy can be fraught at the best of times. Serious high-level events are regularly punctuated with physical gaffes, miscues, awkward handshakes, strained laughter, and cultural faux pas of varying scope. Like the time President Donald Trump appeared to shove the Prime Minister of Montenegro at a NATO summit. Or when President Barack Obama got caught on a hot mic, complaining to then-French President Nicolas Sarkozy about the Prime Minister of key U.S. ally, Israel. Or, perhaps most spectacularly, when President George H.W. Bush threw up on Japan's Prime Minister during a state dinner. At the worst of times, like in the middle of a pandemic, when leaders can't meet in person to hash out important issues, diplomacy can be excruciating. This includes the agonizingly long pause during a recent virtual U.S.-led climate summit, when the French president was cut off mid-speech and the screen cut to a silent Russian president. By now, millions of people around the world have suffered through the awkwardness of virtual meetings and their many technical hazards. They include video glitches, missed cues, hot mics, and, oops, when you accidentally use that one Zoom filter that turns your face into a cat. But in meetings of global importance, going virtual raises serious concerns. Before the pandemic began, major summits were a hub of human activity, commonly drawing civil society groups and protesters into the same space as major decision makers. Now, with everything online, more people can watch the proceedings. But, says Mandeep Tawana of Civicus, the Global Civil Society Alliance, fewer people can actually participate and enjoy their freedoms of assembly and expression.
Online, these rights should be as equally available as they are offline. So that's critical. Secondly, we are also urging that when meetings are being organized by intergovernmental institutions, multilateral bodies, and so on, that they try to reach a vast swath of people. But most importantly, I think internet should be recognized as a very important human right.
Virtual diplomacy is likely here to stay, even after the pandemic, says Brooke Spector, a former American diplomat turned journalist who's lived in South Africa for decades. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken went fully virtual for his first Africa trip this week, spending a day going electronically between high-level meetings in Kenya and Nigeria. Blinken adapted quickly to the screen, Spector said.
To the extent to which Tony Blinken shows the same kind of ability and warmth through the camera that the president can manage to do is going to stand him in good stead, because this, I suspect, is going to be the way of the world for quite a while. There'll be a lot fewer international visits and a whole lot more international consultations by way of the electronics.
But Spector said, don't mistake the novel format for fresh, new, or even honest content. One thing remains essential to diplomacy, no matter the medium: preparation. These engagements are just as rehearsed as they ever were, he says.
Virtual diplomacy, it's like anything else. It's only as good as the staff work that precedes it. If it's entirely an open-ended discussion in which a dozen or more people are participating, the result is something approaching chaos.
Or whatever that was last week. when the world watched global leaders looking on helplessly for 88 agonizing seconds as President Vladimir Putin stared blankly into the middle distance, fidgeted, and gestured mutely off camera. It could have been worse. So far, the Zoom cat face filter has yet to make its diplomatic debut. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.